Welcome to Equity Granted, an executive chat where we help guide you, the senior level corporate executive of a publicly traded company, toward personal financial peace of mind. In the coming weeks, we'll walk you through financial parity planning when choosing career paths, pension decisions, general stock-based compensation, planning for the special needs of a family member, and planning for the international expatriate executive. SFG's sister company is SFG Investment Advisors, an SEC-registered investment advisor. Our website is sfgadvisors.com, spelled S as in Sam, F as in Frank, G as in George, ADVISORS.com. Let's start our conversation.
Welcome to Equity Granted, an executive chat. My name is Steve Moyer. I'm the Director of Planning Administration at SFG Wealth Planning Services. SFG is an independent firm that helps senior-level executives of publicly traded companies by guiding them and helps them to deal with the complexities of their stock-based compensation and unique financial planning needs. I'm here today with Chuck Stigge, founder and CEO of SFG. Chuck has over 36 years of experience and is very passionate about helping individuals by guiding them toward financial peace of mind. He gets excited when it comes to helping executives achieve their personal and family financial goals. Chuck has several professional certifications, including the Certified Financial Planner and Certified Equity Professional designations. In addition, Chuck is a licensed practitioner and member of Kingdom Advisors, along with being a member of the National Association of Stock Plan Professionals. Welcome, Chuck.
Thank you, Steve. That's your introduction is greatly appreciated. You're exactly correct. I love talking about equity compensation. And I get super jazzed when it comes to how these plans make a real positive impact on an executive. This is the first episode of many in our season. Our specific focus today is financial parity planning. And with that, we're looking forward to the conversation that we're going to have with our first guest. So today, I'm very honored to welcome our guest. He's a gentleman who is a managing director for BDO. He's a leader of the compensation practice with them. And with an expertise on employee stock programs, prior to joining BDO, our guest was the global practice leader for Aon, in which he oversaw all of their equity and governance services with over 1,000 public and private companies. His specific domain expertise is with regard to equity design, corporate governance, and valuation accounting under AS 718. As a strong proponent of performance equity, he has a mission and quite frankly, a strong desire to innovate, to tighten the alignment of pay for performance. He was on the FASB board, FASB roundtable on employee share options, and is the chairperson of the Society of Actuaries Task Force on Stock Option Valuation. Our guest has formerly been on the advisory board for both the National Association of Stock Plan Professionals and has won an Individual Achievement Award for the NASPP and the CEP Institute. Terry, our guest, studied mathematics at Georgetown University, where he is also a captain of the Hoya tennis team. And I might add, Terry is not only an athlete, but an avid tennis player. And so I'm excited to hear more about that. So please join me in welcoming Terry Adamson as our guest to this episode.
Thanks, Chuck. This is great to be here. It's going to be quite a cerebral conversation. I'm actually looking forward to a little bit later today, getting out of the cerebral mode, go outside and play some tennis. Actually, tonight's going to be some platform tennis, paddle tennis, which is a great wintertime sport here in Philadelphia.
And COVID is not restricting you from being able to play a sport you love.
Well, I have to wear a mask while playing, but that's, you know, I can take that. That's good.
Good to get the energy and the physical outlet. But Nice to be able to play to your passion.
I love it. But you know what else I love? I love the terminology that you have here, financial parity planning. That's great terminology. Tell me more about that.
Terrence is a senior vice president at a publicly traded company that's been offered an executive director role as an insider with another public company. He finds the new role very appealing, with more responsibility where he'd have a greater impact. He could easily retire from his current role without losing the vesting of his awards, but even though by some standards he's at the tail end of his career, Terrence still has the energy to make his mark elsewhere. Do you have an offer on the table? Are you a senior leader aspiring to enhance your career, contemplating the financial implications of making a move? When an executive is presented with an advanced role at another organization, they have various opportunities they need to compare. The focus shouldn't be on short-term, but long-term wealth creation, not overlooking the financial implications of leaving money on the table. What would the new company need to offer to augment what they already have? Financial parity planning is the intricate process of comparing the complexities of the current grants and what the new company will offer for the purpose of helping the executive meet and exceed their personal financial goals.
So, Terry, maybe you could talk a bit about, for an executive that's aspiring to move up to a higher level role, in the context of financial parity planning, what are some of the considerations going into a negotiation?
Wow, this is a big challenge, but really important. You know, I think executives will always want to try to be made whole on a total rewards basis. So not only made whole for what their current ownership is, but also kind of made whole going forward prospectively. And made whole is tough. You know, it's really tough to define, you know, and you probably want to start on a total rewards basis. So not only looking at base pay and not only looking at bonus, but looking at things like retirement programs, 401ks, and all these other benefits. But one of the, you know, I think our subject today more often is probably going to focus on equity and stock. And being made whole when you're comparing these different job alternatives is really tough to think about when it's stock, because the perceived value from every executive is different on stock. But what I like to think about when I start this process is, to start with, there's probably three forms of stock that we really want to classify into different cohorts. Those three forms would be time-based restricted stock, number one. Number two, stock options that you have from the prior company and the different alternatives that you're looking at. And then lastly, number three, performance shares. And for each of those cohorts, each of these different categories, we're going to think about them in a little bit of a different way. Probably the easiest way to think about them is, you know, I'd probably like to think about each one of them in three ways. What I would call the lowest value, a fair value in the middle, and then a maximum value. Restricted stock, I'm going to start with that. That's the easiest, right? Because the unvested restricted stock is what it is. For sense of examples, let's just say you've got $100,000 worth of restricted stock from a prior company that is unvested. And it's going to be the same. The low value, the high value, the fair value, that's all going to be the same. Now move into the next category, stock options. It adds a layer of complexity, because the unvested value of stock options can be thought of, that low value, the lowest value of them, is probably the intrinsic value, which is simply the stock price minus the strike price times the number of them you have outstanding. The highest value, though, because not only greater than the intrinsic value, there's time value left in them. You might have 5 years left, 7 years left. So you could value those using a Black-Scholes model or something like that, with about a 7-year expected life going out into the future. That would be the maximum value. And there might be some fair value, which is the midpoint of that. And then lastly, the third category, performance shares, that gets even a little bit more challenging. There were some target of performance shares that you may have been granted, but there's a risk associated with them that you won't achieve them. And then there's a
probably an upside associated with those performance shares on the maximum side. So for each of these three categories, I recommend coming up with a minimum value, which would be the intrinsic value for stock options, and if the performance shares aren't paid out, a fair value, your best estimate of it, and then a maximum value of what it could be earned out at. And coming up with a total portfolio of your unvested awards, minimum value, maximum value, and that's going to be your negotiation range on the low end, on the high end, and then you're going to start that negotiation process somewhere in between there. I don't know. Does that make sense?
It does. And Terry, your perspective is invaluable because obviously you come at this from the employer as a consultant to the issuer companies, to large organizations. You're thinking from the perspective of how to best design these plans to not only retain and incent, but also to inspire performance. Mm-hmm. And I know that performance awards in particular are your area of expertise. So for you, the executive that's listening, it's very helpful for you, we believe, to hear the company's perspective on why they put the plans together that they do. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about some of the latitude that a prospective employer might have when it comes to the negotiation table. What constraints do they have? What flexibility do they have in terms of the type of awards that they're granting at that point of negotiation?
Yeah, I think generally that negotiation for most executives coming over is going to start with restricted stock. It's simplest. You probably don't want to have performance awards for the normal executive that'll be distinct and separate than the rest of the executives. So they'll probably try to make people whole in that negotiation with restricted stock. The easiest to understand. It will also be unvested, and it will have a new vesting schedule. And that new vesting schedule will very likely be longer than what it was unvested at the prior company. You know, I know that might make people pause. That means it will be longer before that they receive that money. But I urge your executives probably not to worry about that because the value is still going to be there. It just means you won't be able to access it and be liquid in it for a later point in time. And think of stock, again, as a deferred compensation program. Even though you're deferred for a longer period of time, there is a possibility, a probability, that it's just a deferred comp and you can defer taxes and you might get more later if the stock appreciates. So one thing that I would expect is probably going to be form of restricted stock more often than not. Number two, there is a little bit of latitude in granting stock here because for inducement grants, for new hire grants that you're bringing on, they don't always need to be out of the share of plans that have been approved by shareholders. You can grant shares and have inducement grants for people that are outside of the plan, that are carved out of the normal plan. So that's one possibility there.
Yeah, and I think that addresses the question because obviously the share plans themselves really drive what's available to grant. So I think it's helpful for the executive that's considering financial parity planning for themselves to know what latitude. So basically what you're saying is there's two major types of awards where a prospective employer is going to have the flexibility, restricted stock or restricted stock units, but also non-qualified options. Yeah. Is that correct? Or stock options in general?
Yeah. You know, and stock options have their pros and cons. And I'm a big advocate of stock options over my life because it really truly is in line with the investor. You have to drive the stock price up to necessarily get paid and to earn money. Now, that being said, there is a pay equity issue with stock options sometimes because you get stock options one day upon your hire and you have a grant price and a strike price that day. That strike price may be different than somebody that was hired a month later. And that strike price may be different than somebody that was hired a month before. And that strike price might be different than all those other employees that got something on their normal focus grant. The problem with that is because stock options are so leveraged and volatile, that one single executive could get no earnout or a significant earnout based upon the strike price that given day. And, you know, I worry about stock options and from a pay equity perspective of making sure that somebody doesn't earn a lot more than somebody else on a given day. So I generally try to get stock options all aligned so everybody has the same strike price. Everybody's aligned together. I hope that makes sense.
It does. So let's just step back for a minute because obviously this can get a little bit technical. In our experience as a firm, we have found that executives oftentimes look at short-term incentive or STI as the focus for why they're making a decision to make a move. Their base might be bumped up by, you know, a certain percentage with a new employer. Their bonus structure might be very attractive. Maybe they move from a 40% of base to a 50% of base, but they oftentimes lose sight of the real wealth accumulation behind their total compensation. And so what we're trying to drive home in this discussion is the critical aspect of, in the context of sizing up all of your decisions, it's very important to consider your total wealth. You know, what are you leaving on the table versus what you would gain elsewhere? And that's what we call financial parity planning. So with that, Terry, I think as I mentioned just a couple of minutes ago, performance awards are really your area of expertise and specialization. You have I've heard you talk over the years about with great passion about the importance of aligning performance with pay. Can you talk a little bit about that? And can you also talk about some of the trends?
Yeah, you have absolutely found my geeky passions. So one of the frameworks and philosophies that I like to fall back on when it comes to total rewards and how you get paid is I like to back up and think of who are the stakeholders of executive comp.
And I love this because I've heard you explain this before.
I ramble on a lot. But the stakeholders that I generally think about in the rewards decision is number one, the employee, number two, the company, and number three, the investor. And then I think about the three different forms of compensation out there. And we all know what those three different forms very broadly are. There's base pay, there's short-term incentives, STI, the bonus, the annual bonus, and then there's long-term incentives, the stock, the equity programs. Well, base pay and the employee are one-for-one directly related. The short-term incentives and the company are very strongly correlated because very frequently short-term incentives are a form of profit-sharing agreement between the employee and the company. So that leaves the third stakeholder as being the investor, and the third form of compensation is LTI. And those are really important to be directly aligned and get that pay-for-performance alignment. And so what we're seeing is a greater shift towards those investor alignments and a lot of pressure by investors to make sure that they're aligned. Now, I'm talking a lot. My core philosophy. Now, over the last couple years, there's been a couple new shifts. The Business Roundtable, a group of CEOs, identified five stakeholders. I already laid out three, but they then subdivided the company into customers, suppliers, and the community. Okay, so then how can we design incentive programs that address customers, suppliers, and the community? That's really interesting. And truthfully, it's arguable if it should, but I'm not going to get into that debate right now. Where I think there's a lot of pressure right now going forward with pay-for-performance alignment and performance shares is adding in measures for the community at large and how to do that at best. We're seeing that in the form of ESG goals, goals on the environment, social measures, and governance. And, you know, right now, I think where we're seeing more and more discussion is particularly in the S of ESG. The social measures and diversity and inclusion goals and D&I goals. And I think all boards of directors and compensation committees are really thinking about how to best address that. So that's where one of the newest focus is going forward.
So, Terry, in the context of performance awards specifically, maybe you can shed a little bit of light on some of the thinking behind conventional metrics, how they're valued. Maybe you could talk about that from the perspective of a return on assets and so on. Could you comment on, you know, what's been in your wheelhouse?
Yeah. Well, what I'm thinking about right now, I'm spending a lot of time thinking about is I've classified all performance measures into one of four dimensions. And the first dimension of performance measure is what I would call top-line revenue, just sales, top-line. A two-dimensional performance measure is a measure that has top-line and bottom-line in it. So that would be an example of that would be cash flow or EBITDA or operating income, net margins. Moving on to the third dimension, it not only takes into account top line and bottom line, but takes into account funding of the company. So the investments of the company. So a three-dimensional measure would be earnings per share. A three-dimensional measure would be return on invested capital, return on equity, return on assets, which I think you said. Lastly, a four-dimensional measure not only takes into account the first three dimensions, but a four-dimensional measure takes into account the future. What do I mean by the future? That's really converting something from an intrinsic value to a fair value. And realistically, the only four-dimensional measure that's out there is total shareholder return. So those are the four dimensions of performance metrics that I categorize things in my head. I do have a fifth bucket, a catch-all, just a strategic goal. And maybe that performance metric could be a drug approval, or maybe it could be an ESG goal or D&I that we brought about earlier, but it's not necessarily part of the operational measures. So when I think about these five different categories of performance measure, what I'm finding is that if a company has a portfolio of these metrics, not just a metric on 4D on stock price, not just a measure on EBITDA or cash flow, but has a broad portfolio in each of those dimensions, that's where I'm seeing the best plan designs out there into the marketplace. And that's where I think we're ultimately heading. And so if you have a 2D measure in your short-term incentive plan, if the short-term incentive plan is paying out on operating income, then you probably want to move on your long-term incentive plan to a 3D or 4D measure. So something like that it takes into account the investments or stock price into it.
So this is invaluable for you as the executive listening. You're thinking, okay, this is all very helpful to understand the thinking process on the part of a compensation committee, the board of directors, the executive leadership when it comes to how to structure these plans. We could just kind of take a step back because the executive who's an up-and-comer, why would all of this be important? So if you're, let's say, I mean, I'll just use an example of one of our clients that left a role with a Fortune 100 company, was inspired to make a move to an executive VP level, became an NEO, named executive officer, insider, with a smaller NASDAQ company, and was able to move from a fairly large structure where all decision points were pretty vast. There were a number of players and there became bureaucracy to where he was able to go and make a direct impact on, and there was a bit more flexibility and he was able to be a bit more nimble in terms of the business growth. So trying to think in terms of what an executive is contemplating, why would all of this be important? Why would the structure of a PSU be important for an up-and-comer? Why, you know, if maybe they've growing their careers, they focus largely on short-term compensation, and now they're moving up within the organization. Why would this all be important to them, do you think?
Well, we've certainly seen that the value that equity compensation can deliver, certainly over the last 10 years, the returns from the market and from equities are just massive. Now, going back to these four dimensions that we just talked about, let's say your example, and it was a great example, let's say your example when he was at a larger company at but was not necessarily a named executive officer. What I like about these dimensions to think about is in that first dimension where you're measuring goals on top-line revenue, that's perfect for salespeople. That second dimension where it's net income or based upon top and bottom line, that's perfect for people that run lines of business. But as you get into the third and fourth dimension where you get into capital funding and you get into stock price return, that's perfect for named executive officers and Section 16 officers that are making investment decisions for the organization.
That's helpful. So if you're an up-and-comer and you're contemplating maybe you rise to the level of a C-suite, Section 16, which, again, for the listeners, Section 16 are the most senior level execs within an organization. They're very much in the public eye. They might be one of the five top paid, certainly the CEO, CFO. When an executive is contemplating making this type of a move, what type of awards do you think, Terry, are going to provide them the greatest impact in terms of their personal wealth accumulation?
It's a challenging question, and I think it's all a matter, comes down to that perceived value and what person's tolerance of risk is. Now, if you're pretty bullish on the new organization that you're going to, there's no doubt that stock options are leveraged. If your tolerance for risk is low, then restricted stock is fantastic. It's just a matter of waiting it out, and you have deferred comp and you have deferred taxes. So, you know, if it were me and it was a one-time, I knew this were a one-time transition, I'd probably want to get the restricted stock to lock it in. But going forward, and I knew I were going to be getting grants every year, I'd probably be pretty bullish on myself, and I'd want more highly leveraged upside opportunities. I'd want those lottery tickets.
So financial parity planning really comes down to weighing all of this in. And I guess the question is, how much time would it take an executive to recover what they might be leaving on the table by leaving their current employee and taking on a role elsewhere? And that really does require sitting down, running the machinations. In our firm, we have done this. I used the example of this executive where he did make this move. And we looked at the volatility. You talked about risk, Terry. Mm-hmm. We looked at the volatility of the new company because it was on the smaller side. Mm-hmm. What would the prospects be 3 years out, 5 years out? Because, of course, that executive is thinking about certainly what's in the best interest of the organization, but they're also thinking, you know, it's got to be smart financially for themselves and their family. So this is an area that we help our clients with. It's not a commonly used term, financial parity planning, but it is in our wheelhouse, and we've seen it make an impact on a real-time basis with our clients. So, Terry, I guess to close this out, any other comments or aspects that we haven't touched on that might be helpful to address?
No, I mean, going back, your terminology, financial parity, I love it. I love it. And a lot of times in my world, I'd hear words, phrases like replacement grants, make whole awards, but I like financial parity better. I think that makes more sense to an executive. And what the actual evaluation and the alternatives they're looking at. Now, you know, going forward, I think it's an exciting time. Without a doubt, stock options, performance awards, they are getting better and better. You know, ultimately, from a corporate perspective, what I always want is to create fair arrangements between the company, corporation, and the employee. And how we define fair can be a lot of ways, but it's really a balance, like I said, a profit sharing agreement between the investor and the employee. And we do want to have tight pay for performance alignments. It's not always easy, right? You know, sometimes performance measures aren't always aligned with stock price, and there might be artificial reasons why. But if you build in some of those buffers, build in
equitable grant dates, build in transparent ways of communicating these awards, then without a doubt, I think that there's a tighter and tighter alignment between pay for performance.
Any similarities between a tennis match and a negotiation?
I think this negotiation is a lot more emotional than a tennis match, at least for me. I think these negotiations can be quite emotional, depending on, leaving a company that you've poured your life into, which can be really, really tough. And starting your life anew, to throw your life into a new career, a new job, that's awesome.
Yeah, and a tennis court, I guess you've got defined lines, but when you're making a career move, that things aren't always defined.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Terry, thank you so much for taking your time, sharing your expertise, your thought leadership with us and with our executives and the listener. Absolutely invaluable. Would like to close this out by just extending our appreciation to you for your willingness to give of your time.
Oh, I'm blessed, Chuck, and thank you for having me. And you're a fantastic one.
Great. Thank you, Terry.
Yeah, so Chuck, that was a great conversation with Terry. It was really intriguing, a lot of valuable information there. A couple of things that I really appreciated that he pointed out was just the fact that there's some flexibility with sign-on packages for executives where the company can go outside of the normal plan design. I thought that was helpful information. I also thought it was really intriguing how he talked about additional shareholders or stakeholders that have been identified, and thinking about the potential for these plans to be designed to include them in the future and what that might look like, for example, communities as well as customers. So I thought that was really interesting what he pointed out. I'm curious, though, if you have any final thoughts to add for the executives who are listening in here today.
Well, Terry touched on a number of things, including who the stakeholders are. He mentioned three primary, but then added on five, two additional. He also talked about ranges when it comes to valuation, intrinsic, fair value, and future value when it comes to negotiating. And then, of course, he talked about the different dimensions, which, have been in the forefront of his thinking lately. I can't help as an advisor to an executive how critically important it is not to get into too much of the technical weeds. All of these elements are critical to making a decision. But taking a step back, when you think about financial parity planning, you have to think about this in the context of your overall decision-making. Sure, you want to be, you're looking for an opportunity to take on greater responsibility, whether it's heading up a major business unit or it being a more senior level role, overseeing a large portfolio company. You're thinking about how professionally rewarding that will be, having more people that you're responsible for overseeing, how you can best deploy your leadership in a new role. All of that is absolutely important, how your family, personal life is going to be improved through this decision. But we strongly recommend that you do not overlook the importance of financial parity planning. And it really does come down to doing an analysis. Bottom line, what am I leaving on the table if I make this move? What would I need to gain by making the move? And what do I need to negotiate so that I'm on par, if not better off, 3 or 5 years down the road? Does that make sense?
Absolutely, yeah. Chuck, I'm just curious. I know this was a great topic. We have more great topics to come. Would you like to share a little bit about what is to follow?
Be happy to. So we're really excited about this season, and the next episode specifically is around pension planning. certainly pension decisions are big in the mind of an executive. We are seeing a lot of change happening in this space. They can be fairly complex. There are a lot of projections that need to be made when it comes to the various ways of receiving a payout from a pension, whether it's a defined benefit or whether it's a defined contribution plan. So all of these we're going to look at in the context of you, your situation as an executive, and what the impact is on your personal financial planning.
Can't wait. Thank you for joining us today on Equity Granted and Executive Chat. We hope you join us for the next time. Take care.
The likelihood of various investment outcomes is hypothetical. Discussion of these possible outcomes do not represent actual investment results. All investment strategies have the potential for profit or loss. Changes in investment strategies, contributions, or withdrawals may materially alter the performance and results of a portfolio. Different types of investments involve varying degrees of risk, and there can be no assurance that any specific investment will be suitable or profitable for a client's investment portfolio. Nothing provided herein constitutes tax advice. Individuals should seek the advice of their own tax advisor for specific information regarding tax consequences of investments. This discussion may contain forward-looking statements relating to the objectives, opportunities, and the future performance of the U.S. market generally. Forward-looking statements may be identified by the use of such words, believe, expect, anticipate, should, planned, estimated, potential, and other similar terms. Example of forward-looking statements include, but are not limited to, estimates with respect to financial condition, results of operations, and success or lack of success of any particular investment strategy. All are subject to various factors included, but are not limited to, general and local economic conditions, changing levels of competition within certain industries and markets, changes in interest rates, changes in legislation or regulation, and other economic, competitive, governmental, regulatory, and technological factors affecting a portfolio's operations that could cause actual results to differ materially from projected results. Such statements are forward-looking in nature and involve a number of known and unknown risks, uncertainties, and other factors, and accordingly, actual results may differ materially from those reflected or contemplated in any forward-looking statements. Prospective investors are cautioned not to place undue reliance on any forward-looking statements or examples. None of SFG Investment Advisors Inc. or any of its affiliates or principals, nor any other individual or entity, assumes any obligation to update any forward-looking statements as a result of new information, subsequent events, or any other circumstances. All statements made herein speak only as of the date that they were made. SFG Investment Advisors Inc. is an investment advisor in Doylestown, PA. SFG Investment Advisors Inc. is registered with the Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC. Registration of an investment advisor does not imply any specific level of skill or training and does not constitute an endorsement of the firm by the commission. SFG Investment Advisors Inc. only transacts business in states in which it is properly registered or excluded or exempted from registration. A copy of SFG Investment Advisors Inc.'s current written disclosure brochure filed with the SEC, which discusses, among other things, SFG Investment Advisors Inc. business practices, services, and fees, is available through the SEC's website at www.advisorinfo.sec.gov.